I think we'll get started. Good morning. Welcome to Grand Rounds, and thank you all for braving the elements to show up. This morning, it's my pleasure to present an esteemed member of our radiology department and a relatively new member, Dr. Alex J. Lewis. Dr. Lewis did his undergraduate training at Vanderbilt. He went on to Emory to do his medical school training, and then while there also got an MBA. He then went on to a Medical College of South Carolina, where he did his radiology training. And subsequent to that, he went to Stanford and did a body MRI fellowship. This morning, Dr. Lewis's lecture is entitled Advancements in GI Radiology. Please join me in welcoming Dr. Lewis.
Thanks so much. I call this lecture Advancements in GI Radiology, but another kind of subtitle of it would be GI Radiology Troubleshooting, because I wanted to cover a couple of different topics which I know that are kind of problematic in GI radiology. One of them is that a lot of the GI radiology tests have confusing names that are similar and not clearly self-explanatory, like esophagram, video esophagram, barium swallow, modified barium swallow, upper GI. And the tests sound very similar but evaluate different things. And a test, you know, an indication like dysphagia might actually, depending on what the dysphagia is, might actually indicate a couple of different tests. Another thing I wanted to talk about that we run into fairly frequently is follow-up of incidental GI findings. And these incidental GI findings are becoming more and more common on, you know, more advanced modalities like MRI. And the third thing I want to talk about is kind of what my passion is, what I did my fellowship in, which is new and advanced techniques in abdominal and pelvic MR. And I'm going to focus on three kind of emerging indications for abdominal and pelvic MR. Those are rectal cancer MR, pancreatic MR, and MR enterography. So before we talk about, you know, the different modalities that are used in GI radiology, one quick, and I won't try to make it too much radiology physics, is the concept of contrast resolution versus spatial resolution. Because people ask often, you know, what's the best test? Is MRI always better than X-ray, always better than CT? And the answer is it depends. It depends on what you're looking for, and it depends on, you know, what exactly the pathology that you're looking for or the indication that you're trying to evaluate. So the first concept is spatial resolution, and this refers to the ability to distinguish two different things that are very close together. And low spatial resolution techniques are unable to differentiate two close things that are close together. And in this area, X-ray is actually the best. X-ray has great spatial resolution. You can distinguish things that are very, very close together, less than 1 millimeter apart on X-ray. Whereas MRI is actually the worst at spatial resolution. So MRI, it's actually things kind of blur together often. And so it's a little harder to distinguish very close things together. And then there's contrast resolution, which is sort of our 50 shades of gray, the different shades of that you can distinguish on imaging. And so in this indication, MRI is actually by far the best. So this is sort of for evaluation of soft tissues. MRI is by far the best, much better than X-ray. So what are the abdominal imaging modalities? And we'll talk about each of these individually. But basically, we all are pretty familiar with X-ray, you know, which sometimes is called KUB, plain film, fluoroscopy. We'll talk about a number of the different fluoro tests that can be ordered, CT, MRI, and ultrasound. And these are all different methods of looking at the same anatomy and the same pathology, and they each have strengths and weaknesses. And remember, again, you know, one of the themes of my talk will be that MRI is not always better than CT, is not always better than X-ray, although I am an MRI guy, so I might say, you know, MR is always the best. But it really depends on what you're looking for and, you know, what the exact question that you need to have answered. Another question that we get asked frequently is with or without contrast. So what does contrast do? So contrast is a substance that's administered into a patient's bloodstream or GI tract and increases that space's conspicuity on imaging. Can we lower the lights a little bit? It might make seeing the images better. Just thinking about that. So the answer for CT particularly and the question we get asked often is, should I give contrast, oral and IV? And the answer is almost always yes, unless, and these are the three instances where I would say that you don't need to give contrast. And that's if you're looking for renal stones, and that's the only thing that you're looking for, only differential consideration is you want to just see where the kidney stone is, then you can give, you do a non-contrast CT. If the patient has renal failure, and here we use a creatinine cutoff of 1.7, thank you, 1.7. So if their creatinine is over 1.7, then you shouldn't give contrast in CT because there's pretty clear data that there's contrast-induced nephropathy is a significant risk. And the third reason you shouldn't give contrast is if the patient's had a prior anaphylactic reaction to CT contrast. We have different pre-medication protocols that we use for CT, but if they've had an anaphylactic reaction, you know, a true anaphylactic reaction, then probably the best not to give them contrast again. So here you can see that contrast improves the resolution and the sensitivity and specificity for the disease. Here you see a renal lesion that's relatively silent on the non-contrast exam, but clearly a renal tumor on the post-contrast evaluation. Not only does it help you see lesions, but contrast also helps you define lesions. Here's on an MR, on an image that you see there's a clear lesion, but as the contrast fills in, you can actually define what this lesion is, and this contrast enhancement pattern of this, what we call peripheral discontinuous enhancement, is classic for a giant hemangioma in this case. So not only does it help you see the lesion, it also helps you define and make a very specific diagnosis as to what the lesion is. So starting with X-ray, so plain old X-ray. So what can you see on X-ray? What is X-ray good for? X-ray is good for bones and other calcified or dense metallic objects, so determining radiopaque foreign bodies. You can see gas patterns, so there's sort of, you know, normal gas pattern, you know, non-specific gas pattern where you see some gas in the colon and in the small bowel, but it's not, you know, it doesn't clearly follow a pattern. And then you see patterns that are classic for small bowel obstruction, and we'll see some of those. And then it has great spatial resolution. We talked about, you know, that you can distinguish very close together objects on X-ray, but the contrast resolution is not very good. There's only maybe two or three different shades of gray in X-ray. So what should you order X-ray for? So screening for pneumoperitoneum, if you're worried that the person is perforated, then definitely X-ray is a, you know, quick and easy way to determine that. Screening for bowel obstruction or ileus, we talked about, you know, there's a specific pattern for small bowel obstruction that we'll see. It's great for evaluating tube placements or evaluating for radiopaque foreign ingested bodies, capsule endoscopy, swallowed coins in children, things like that. It's kind of bad at everything else. You know, you can't diagnose appendicitis. Maybe you can see gallstones sometimes. Gastroenteritis, you're not going to see. And cancer without any kind of contrast. Again, X-ray is not great for that. Some radiographic variations. So people ask another question is, should I get a supine X-ray, abdominal X-ray? Should I get an upright X-ray? The answer, just like with contrast, is I would always try to get an upright X-ray or a lateral decubitus view if the person can't stand up. It's useful. A huge amount of free air can be hidden on a supine X-ray. So if another one of the key pearls I can have you guys take away is, if you can, you know, when you order an abdominal X-ray, always order an abdominal series or, at least two views with an upright or a decubitus view if the person can't stand. Because here you can see a clear outline of free gas on this patient that might have been silent on a supine film. And, you know, you can actually give a contrast dye and then take an X-ray. There used to be a test called intravenous pyelogram. We don't really do those anymore. But basically you give the person a contrast injection and then take an X-ray, and it can show you your renal pathology. And then, you know, you can also give, after a G-tube placement or a Dabhoff placement, inject contrast and determine the exact location of where a tube might be. So another X-ray here on an upright view, you can see clearly gas below the diaphragms signaling pneumoperitoneum. Here, small bowel obstruction with dynamic gas fluid levels, dilated small bowel loops in the mid-abdomen, paucity of gas in the colon. So this would be a small bowel obstruction that you can diagnose without having to go to CT. You might get CT to define where the transition point is or look for other complications of small bowel obstruction. But at least on this X-ray, you know, the emergency room or in your office, you can say, okay, this person has a small bowel obstruction. They need to be treated for that just on the X-ray. And then we talked about tube placement. Here, this is a Dobhoff tube. You can see, you know, that the tube is coming down through the duodenum and getting into the jejunum, so that you could confirm where this where the tube was just on X-ray. So fluoroscopy, the next thing, and this is a region, something that used to be done very often. It was one of the primary modalities for GI radiology imaging. It's kind of become less utilized with the advents of CT and MR, but there are still some important indications for fluoroscopy, and a lot of the tests are sort of confusing with their names. So it's basically using X-rays, but you're actually, the radiologist is watching while the person is ingesting contrast. So it's kind of like a movie of X-rays. And we give contrast to determine the lumen of whatever space we're trying to determine. And this provides anatomic and functional information. So some of the routine fluoroscopic studies are, here we see esophagram, upper GI, and barium enema. I'll talk about esophagram first. So a traditional esophagram, if you order an esophagram, really images the thoracic esophagus. So that'll be basically from the level of the clavicles to the level of the stomach. If you ask a person who has dysphagia, where does it hurt when you swallow, and they point to their chest, you should get an esophagram. If they say, oh, it hurts up here, food sticks up in my throat or in the back of my mouth, that would be more what we'd call a video esophagram or a cervical esophagram, and that's something that's done with speech pathology. So that's a different test, and that's probably actually, if you ask people where does it hurt or where does food stick, it's usually much more common up here, but sometimes people will point, you know, at their chest, and that would be a traditional esophagram. Esophagrams are good for dysphagia in the chest and strictures, things like achalasia. And then also rarely we see masses at the distal esophagus on esophagram, although, you know, that would be more of a screening tool, and then you would go to endoscopy. Another test, upper GI. So this is a test that if, again, a person's saying they have dysphagia or they're pointing to their chest, this probably isn't the best test. If the person is saying that it hurts in their upper abdomen, then upper GI would be a better test. This looks at primarily the stomach and the proximal portion of the small bowel, the duodenum. So this shows will show a mass, ulcer in the stomach or the duodenum, and then this also will show gastroesophageal reflux, although we can evaluate for reflux on esophagram. Just because we don't see reflux on an esophagram or an upper GI doesn't mean that the patient doesn't have it. We put them in a few different maneuvers that may or may not, you know, show the reflux over the course of a few seconds or minutes. And then the last one is a barium enema, which is a test that we're not doing quite as often. This used to be the primary screening tool for colon masses. Now we're doing CT colonography and more commonly colonoscopy to evaluate for these things. But sometimes people fail colonoscopy. And the main reason that we do these now are two different reasons. One is we evaluate post-surgical change, so basically a surgical anastomosis to make sure it's intact. We also have this test called HIPAC enema, which we actually do a fairly it's a unique, almost unique Boca Raton radiology exam, where basically it's a therapeutic enema that's done in radiology. It's a very very strong enema for patients who have longstanding constipation, which is a very large concern in our patient population. That test does have risks. The HIPAC is very, very hyperosmolar, and so there's large fluid shifts. So that would be another, you know, test that would be kind of a last indication for patients who have failed all conservative management for constipation. Here's some of the classic barium enema findings. Here we see a kind of apple core carcinoma. We rarely see this, but, you know, basically a fixed luminal narrowing in this case in the descending colon. Another test we sort of skipped over was a small bowel follow-through. So basically this test, the patient ingests contrast and they take serial radiographs over somewhere between an hour and 3 hours. So it's a, you know, explain to your patient this is going to be, they're going to be there for a while. And basically we watch the contrast over time pass through the small bowel. Here we see a luminal narrowing in the terminal ileum. This patient had Crohn's, where you can clearly see that there's abnormal small bowel in this region. This test is good for small bowel lesions, such as polyps or masses in the small bowel. This is a difficult region to reach with endoscopy. Although this is slowly being replaced by another technique that we'll talk about in our advancements in MRI technique section, which is MR enterography. So moving on to CT. So CT has very good spatial resolution, pretty good contrast resolution, even better when you give IV and oral contrast. The pros of this test are that it gives very good anatomic detail. Pretty much you can diagnose almost anything that would require hospitalization with CT, and it's very quick to acquire. The cons are that it uses ionizing radiation, and this is something that's obviously in the news and patients are concerned about, is, you know, the risks of radiation. CT, the radiation risks, the radiation is relatively low, but it's something to keep in mind. Patients who have Crohn's disease or things like that that are getting 8 or 10 CT scans a year at a very young age, MR might be a better technique for them, or, you know, some other imaging modality that doesn't use quite as much radiation. And CT is not very good in the pelvis. CT doesn't penetrate bones very well. And so the GYN pathology is better evaluated with MR. Here we see our classic CT of a normal appendix here, and then appendicitis on the right. That's a classic indication for CT. Here we see our non-contrast CT that we talked about with kidney stones here in the proximal renal collecting system, which looks like there's some hydro associated with that. Here, after contrast administration, we see a CT that shows multiple liver lesions and ascites. Again, you know, giving you an idea of what the underlying picture going on with this patient is. And finally, MR. So MR has great contrast resolution, pretty good spatial resolution. It's a great problem-solving technique that we'll talk about a little bit more. The pros, it shows soft tissue very, very well. Great at solid organ pathology, great in the pelvis. The cons are it's expensive, although this is a relatively expensive as the scan times come down. This idea of long acquisition times. Most of our MRs can be done in 15 to 20 minutes. Most importantly, probably in our patient population, is that the quality of MR is much more dependent on patient cooperation than CT. So if you're going to order an MR on a patient, make sure that they can follow commands, that they're lucid, that they can hold their breath, because most MR techniques, particularly in GI radiology, require, you know, 15 to 20 second breath holds, which, you know, if you try doing it now, is not, you know, an insignificant thing. So if your patient is, you know, has advanced dementia or delirious or very poor lung function, MR might not be the best test. And here's just some examples in the same patient of the detail that you can see on CT versus the detail that you can see on MR. And MR has, you can see the soft tissues, the outlines of the soft tissues better and identify pathology in soft tissues and solid organs better than CT. Common MRCP that here you see stones in the common bile duct, and that's something that you wouldn't routinely see on CT. Here's a case of an entity we call adenomyosis, which is basically a focal infiltration of endometrium into the myometrium in the uterus, and you can see the soft tissue detail of the uterus that you wouldn't see on CT. Here's a case of rectal cancer. We'll talk a little bit more about that, where you can clearly see differentiating soft tissue planes. Again, wouldn't see that on CT. So wrapping up that section, so remember the basics of resolution. MR is not always better than CT, is not always better than X-ray. It depends on what you're looking for, the different modalities in GI radiology, whether you should give contrast. And if you don't know what to do, then call and ask. It's always better to ask before you order and the patient's down and drinking contrast or getting the wrong tests and the patient's been exposed to radiation or had to go through an intensive examination that didn't answer the question that you were wondering about. So moving on to another common thing in GI radiology that we get asked about frequently are managing all these incidental findings. As MRs become more more commonly utilized. We see a lot more things, which is a blessing and a curse. And that we see a lot of these kind of incidental lesions. And then the question is, we found these things. Now, what do we do? And the patient reads the report and they want to know, you know, what do I do with this? Do I have cancer? So things that, you know, we see this in are in the pancreas with pancreatic cystic lesions, renal cystic lesions, and liver lesions. So we'll talk about pancreatic cysts, pseudocysts, benign neoplasms. We'll talk about the different categorizations of renal cysts. And then we'll talk about liver lesions, hemangiomas, FNH, and adenomas, sort of the benign liver lesions. So starting with pancreatic cystic lesions, when we say pancreatic cysts, what do we mean? So there's pseudocysts, which we'll talk about a little bit more, but are the most common cystic neoplasm or cystic lesion in the pancreas. Serous cystic neoplasms, which are serous cystadenoma, which is a benign entity that doesn't need follow-up. You usually see them in older women. Serous cystadenocarcinoma, which is very rare. Mucinous neoplasm, so mucinous cystic neoplasm, which is a benign entity but is treated surgically. Serous intrapapillary mucinous neoplasms, which we'll talk about quite a bit. These are these little dilated side branches that we see on all of our scans that are the curse of every GI radiologist and GI doctor now, because they have to be followed and they're hard to explain to patients, I would say. And then there are cystic tumors, cystic cancers like neuroendocrine tumor. Traditional pancreatic ductal adenocarcinoma can be cystic, and Acinar cell tumors can also be cystic. And then there's some rare other entities that have some cystic components, like solid pseudopapillary tumor, lymphoepithelial cysts, and true cysts, which we'll talk about in a second. So the most common kind of differentiating tree in these cystic lesions is pseudocyst, which we talked about are the most common GI lesion that we'll see, and anything that kind of falls in the cystic tumors, whether it be serous cystadenoma, IPMN, or mucinous lesions, or cancer. So pseudocysts and cystic tumors have sort of very different patterns of who they happen in and what the clinical presentation is. So pseudocysts are more common in males. They're more common in patients with history of acute or chronic pancreatitis, more common in alcoholic pancreatitis. The patient will have an elevated serum amylase. When they're aspirated under ERCP or EUS, you'll see that fluid is relatively either clear or bloody. The fluid will have a high amylase level. They won't have high tumor markers. Usually one well-differentiated cyst, although they can have a few pseudocysts, no solid components. Calcification is usually diffuse in the pancreas. You usually see a communication between the pancreatic duct and the pseudocyst if you do MR. Although on CT, often you won't clearly define that communication. Patient will usually have underlying features of chronic pancreatitis, and the cyst will usually have a thick wall and underlying abnormal pancreas. For these cystic tumors, they're actually more common in females. There's no really risk factors. They don't have to have had pancreatitis, usually haven't had pancreatitis. Usually these are incidental findings. Their amylase is normal. In these mucinous lesions, the fluid can be thick and mucoid. The tumor markers can be positive. They can have enhancing solid components. We'll talk about that. There can be rarely focal calcification, but usually the underlying pancreas is normal. So there are many of these cysts which don't require any intervention or any follow-up. So pseudocysts, unless they're causing obstruction, you don't have to follow them. You can kind of leave them alone. They'll either stay there forever and not bother the patient, or they'll go away on their own. If they're causing the patient symptoms like GI obstruction or things like that, then you might consider draining them or doing some sort of treatment. Serous cystadenoma is a benign lesion that doesn't need to be followed. It has classic features on CT and MR. Mucinous neoplasms, those are usually surgical. These IPMNs are what we'll talk about a little bit more, because they're the lesions that we see that we don't really have. We haven't had good outcomes data to follow them. There are guidelines as to how often to follow them and when to follow them and how long to follow them for. And we'll talk about that in a second. And then, all these tumors, those are all surgical. And then we'll talk about these true cysts a little bit more in a second. So pancreatic IPMNs versus true cysts. So IPMNs, these can be side branch or main duct. The treatment is different. For a side branch IPMN, we usually follow them. They usually don't become anything, but we do follow them because they do have a small risk, about 5% of a malignant degeneration. Main duct IPMNs are considered to be a premalignant lesions, and those are treated surgically immediately without any follow-up. These IPMNs are characterized by mucin production, dilation of the pancreatic duct, either the main duct or the side branches, and intraductal papillary growth. So they grow along the duct. So these, by definition, have a ductal communication because they're actually mucinous benign neoplasms that are originating from the duct itself. True cysts in the pancreas, unlike the liver where we call cysts, see these hypodense lesions that we kind of blow off all the time that are cysts or variants of cysts. True cysts are very rare in the pancreas, and they're usually associated with a syndromic illness like autosomal dominant polycystic kidney disease or von Hippel-Lindau. So this is a little bit of a complicated slide, but it's sort of the whole algorithm for following up these lesions. And at the end, we'll kind of get to what I recommend you do, how often you follow them. These are from the consensus guidelines, which are called the Tanaka, T-A-N-A-K-A. He's a radiologist from Japan. The Tanaka guidelines, which suggest how often to follow these lesions. So starting with the initial clinical picture, and this is on you guys, is there any high-risk features of malignancy present in the patient? So does the patient have obstructive jaundice in the setting of a cystic pancreatic lesion? And then are there enhancing solid components within the cyst, or is the main duct more than 10 millimeters in size? So if the main duct is more than 10 millimeters in size, that's a main duct IPMN, and that's a surgical lesion. That doesn't do follow-up. You can't let that go. That needs to be sent to a surgeon. If there's enhancing solid components within a cystic lesion, that's a neoplasm that needs to be also surgically taken out. So if yes, surgery. If no, then you kind of move to another clinical algorithm. Does the patient have pancreatitis? And on imaging, is the cyst more than 3 centimeters? Are there thickened walls? Is the main duct kind of borderline? Or are there non-enhancing solid components? Or is there an abrupt caliber change or stricture in the pancreatic duct? If those features are present, then EUS is sort of the next step in the algorithm. If they're not present, then this is kind of the key for follow-up for these. It's actually based on size. So for size of the largest cyst, if the cyst is less than a centimeter, you should follow it with CT or preferably MR in 2 to 3 years. So that's the recommendation. So if cyst is less than a centimeter, let's say follow up in 2 years. If the cyst is 1 to 2 centimeters, then you do yearly MRIs for 2 years and then go to every 2 years. So less than a centimeter every 2 years, 1 to 2 centimeters yearly for 2 years, and then go to every 2 years. If it's 2 to 3 centimeters, and this is getting into kind of the larger lesions, then you would do an EUS in 3 to 6 months and then alternating EUS and MRI probably every 6 months because this is a high-risk lesion. If the cyst is over 3 centimeters, then you might go to an EUS right at that point, try to aspirate it, try to get cytology. And if it's benign, then I would follow it maybe even every 3 or every 6 months. And if it's a young and healthy patient, you might treat this surgically, even if it has benign characteristics, to avoid having them have to have MRI and EUS every 3 months for the rest of their life. The big question that everyone wonders about is how long do we follow these for? We get asked that all the time. And unfortunately, the data isn't there to say that you can stop. Like with lung nodules, they say if it's stable for 2 years, you can kind of let it go. Unfortunately, that data is not there for these pancreatic cystic lesions. So at this point, these sort of commit the person to almost lifetime follow-up, which is why surgical treatment of the larger lesions, rather than getting these exams, endoscopic ultrasound, or MRI every 3 months for life, might be a preferable treatment. So moving on to renal cysts. So there's a radiologic classification called Bosniak. He is a radiologist in New York. And he basically came up with a classification system for these renal cystic lesions. The classic simple renal cyst that we see on almost every patient is a Bosniak 1. Those need no follow-up. Those are leave-alone lesions. Bosniak 2 lesions have thin septations, which don't enhance, or small hyperdense cysts, so small hemorrhagic cysts. Those also don't need any follow-up. There's a category that's kind of in between benign and malignant called 2F. Those require follow-up. I'll show some examples of all of these. And those have one of three criteria that we'll talk about again. Basically, either they have thick septations, which don't clearly enhance, they are hyperdense cysts, more than 3 centimeters, or they have thick wall calcifications. So if any of those three criteria are present, then those are these this 2F category, and those need follow-up. And then I kind of grouped together Bosniak 3 and 4 because those are neoplasms. Those are surgical immediately. Those don't need follow-up. Those need surgery. So going into a little bit more detail, class 1, water density cysts, smooth margins, no enhancing components. Those are benign. So when we say thin septa, we mean less than 1 millimeter. Calcifications less than 1 millimeter in these hemorrhagic cysts. Those are benign. Class 2F we talked about, likely benign, follow-up imaging indicated. There's no clear consensus on how often to follow this, but I think most people would say follow up in 6 months, at least initially, for these 2F lesions. About 5% of these are malignant. And then class 3 and 4, these are, you know, the cystic renal cell cancers. Here's some examples of kind of a pathology drawing. Bosniak 1, simple cysts, those are benign 100% of the time. Thin septa with microcalcifications, those are benign 100% of the time. These Bosniak 2 lesions with the thicker septations, these are malignant about 5% of the time. And then these category 3 and 4 lesions, either with thick enhancing septations or just clear solid components. And those are, you know, somewhere between 50 and 100% malignant, but those are always surgical. Some examples of these on imaging, on CT. This is a, you know, easy, simple renal cyst we see on everybody. Bosniak 2 lesion. So this is a hyperdense, less than 3 centimeter cyst. Doesn't enhance. This is one of the Bosniak 2F lesions. So this is one that has septation that's slightly thickened. It looks like it's enhancing, but it's too small to put. We put little region of interest markers on things to determine enhancement. This is too small to put a region of interest marker on. And so this cyst, which has a subtle, nodular, subtly enhancing, possibly septation would be 2F. You'd follow this for every 6 months. And then this is, you know, a category 3-4 lesion that's a clear renal cell cancer. Moving on to incidental liver lesions. So these are the things that we kind of group. You'll see in our reports as hepatic hypodensities on CT, hemangiomas, adenomas, focal nodular hyperplasia, cysts, and biliary cyst adenomas all sort of fall into this category. Starting with hemangiomas, other than cysts, these are probably the most common thing that we see in liver lesions, liver hypodensities, maybe even more common than cysts. And these have a traditional progressive classic enhancement pattern that they fill in over time with contrast. They're hyperechoic on ultrasound imaging, and that's sort of a classic characterization of a hemangioma. That's a benign lesion, and it doesn't need to be followed. Another thing that we get asked about often is this idea of adenoma versus FNH. So a little bit of the, you know, kind of 30 seconds of pathology. So adenoma is basically a hyperplastic hepatocyte reaction that doesn't have traditional bile network. It's kind of disorganized hepatocytes. This is a benign process that demonstrates progressive solid enhancement. So this isn't a cystic lesion. We have a new agent called EOVIST, E-O-V-I-S-T, that was made basically for this specific differentiation. So if you're wondering if a lesion is adenoma versus FNH, EOVIST is the best test. For other things, EOVIST doesn't demonstrate the classic enhancement patterns that we associate with traditional gadolinium. And so EOVIST is, you know, not a first-line contrast agent. But if you have this specific question, it's a very good one. So in this case, the last phase we call the hepatobiliary phase at about 20 minutes. Adenoma doesn't take up EOVIST, whereas FNH does. So it's a very easy kind of first-year radiology distinguishing, you know, either there's enhancement in the lesion, and that's FNH, or there's no contrast in the lesion, and that's an adenoma. If it's FNH, there's no follow-up necessary. With adenomas, the follow-up, there's controversy in the literature about whether these need to be followed, how often to follow up. A lot of places are following them up yearly. If the lesion's more than 4 centimeters, then people may start talking about surgery because of the risk of bleeding. There is a small risk of malignant transformation, maybe about 5%. That's also debated in the pathology literature. That hepatocellular carcinoma can arise in these adenomas. but very uncommon. And these are in patients who have normal underlying livers, so usually no cirrhosis. There's risk factors associated with adenoma, like oral contraceptives, so the lesions are more common in women. Biliary cyst adenoma, again, it's a fairly uncommon lesion. These are basically just look like very large cysts. It's not really a obvious radiology diagnosis usually. These are usually either, you know, made with biopsy or with time over follow-up. More common in middle-aged women. It's a benign neoplasm. They usually treat these surgically because there is a risk of malignant transformation. So moving on to kind of what my passion is, and I'll leave a little bit of time for questions at the end because I want to, you know, hear you guys' feedback and see if there's anything that you guys have questions about. Talking about the latest indications and applications of GI MRI. And there's three I wanted to talk about, which are rectal MRI, MR enterography, and pancreatic MR. So what is rectal MR good for? So the rectal surgeons love MR because it basically can stage the patient without them having to do much. And the treatments for advanced rectal cancer is very different from the treatment for just kind of, you know, tumor that is confined to the lumen of the rectum. So you can so basically this T3, we'll talk about the staging a little bit, is the kind of the key differentiator for the rectal surgeon. The presence of perirectal lymph nodes, which upstages the patient, and very important for the patient is the relation of the tumor to the anal canal. Very low rectal tumors, unfortunately, require abdominal perineal resection, which is a surgery that will require a permanent ostomy. And so that's a very morbid procedure, whereas higher rectal tumors can be treated with primary anastomosis, and that's a patient that can regain normal or relatively normal bowel function again. So for a young patient, that's a very important differentiation. So here talking about different kind of stages of tumor growth for rectal cancer, T1 is confined just into the mucosa. T2 tumor grows through the submucosa and extends into but not through the muscularis, so those are the layers of the rectum. T3 tumor extends beyond the muscularis, so you see extension here. This is the serosa, so submucosa, and mucosa, muscularis, and serosa. So T3 tumors extend into the serosa, and T4 tumors invade the adjacent organs. So those are all things that we can distinguish on MR. A little bit of rectal MR anatomy, sort of in the short version. This is a patient who has a rectal tumor. Here you have the rectal lumen. Here's the tumor extending. This band here is the mesorectal fascia. That's the important plane for the rectal surgeons. If the tumor grows into that, then that becomes a radiation prior to surgery associated with chemotherapy. And sometimes these become not surgical because of that. Here, this tumor has tethering extension into the uterus. So those are both things that the rectal surgeon would want to know before, and the patient would want to know before going into the operating room. Here, I'll show some examples of different rectal tumors. Here's a tumor where you see enhancement and nodular tumor growth extending out well beyond the rectal serosal margin. Here you see extension of the tumor again into that mesorectal fascia beyond the rectal lumen. This is a big tumor. You can see here on the T2 and on the post-contrast imaging. Again, rectal MR. Here's a patient that on the sagittal, you know, you can barely see some subtle extension of tumor into that out beyond the serosa. This is the wall of the rectum. And then here on the axial, you can also see those kind of subtle bands of tumor extension beyond the lumen. And then sometimes you see, you know, cases where the tumor is here clearly invading into and filling the entire vagina, and you know, it's basically occlusion of the vaginal canal by the tumor. So moving on to MR enterography, this is another thing that's becoming very popular in GI radiology. So what do you order MR enterography for? So probably our most common indication is evaluating for complications of Crohn's disease. Again, these are young patients that, you know, you don't want to do CTs every 3 months on them for their entire life. So if their symptoms are worsening, you can and you're worried about a fistula or a stricture, this is a great test for that. Also surveillance, see how they're doing on their treatment for their Crohn's disease or ulcerative colitis. evaluation of small bowel lesions. We talked about how MR enterography was replacing small bowel follow-through for this. So polyps, tumors that are not accessible by endoscopy. Remember, you have a 30 feet of small bowel. So a lot of these, you know, the endoscope can't see all of the small bowel. And a common indication, which I think may be our unexplored and probably very useful indication in our patient population, a lot of places are using MR enterography as an indication to work up unexplained abdominal pain. So patients that have had endoscopy, have had CT scans, are not getting better, still complaining about abdominal pain. These patients are more common than you think. I'm sure you guys will see some of these kind of patients. And MR enterography is a great way to look and make sure that there's not something you're missing. So in these patients, and there have been studies that show that about 10 to 15% have had an extensive workup, have been called irritable bowel syndrome or something along those lines, and will have a significant finding that explains their disease, whether it be a tiny intraluminal carcinoid tumor or some other pathology, something like a, you know, Crohn's disease that was mild, that was missed on CT. So this is something to think about, you know, if your patients are frustrated and they feel like their abdominal pain isn't resolving and you're kind of stuck as to what a next test would be, MR enterography is a good use in that setting. Here you see a patient here on the left. You have a post-contrast T1 image which shows clear, you know, mucosal enhancement with engorged, we call vasa recta, as the feeding vessels to the terminal ileum. So this is sort of a classic acute on chronic Crohn's disease. Here we have an image sequence called diffusion-weighted imaging, which basically is very sensitive for inflammation. So this shows that there's restricted diffusion, so basically inflammation in that region. So this is active and chronic Crohn's disease. That's important because the management for the GI doctors, if the patient has only chronic disease, the medication options may be different than if they have active disease that you're trying to manage. Here's a patient with a thick walled on the T2 region of ileum with some upstream dilation, so there may be a component of partial small bowel obstruction there with, again, that kind of comb sign that we talked about of the engorged vasculature, and then a little bit less degree of enhancement in the mucosa on this patient. So this is a patient that has predominantly chronic Crohn's disease with probably a stricture in that region with some developing small bowel obstruction. So this would be somebody that you would watch who might be a more surgical patient. We'll show some more examples of that were actually treated surgically. Here's another patient with a long segment of wall thickening in the terminal ileum. Again, this is very T2 hypo-intense in the wall, so predominantly chronic. But still with a little bit of mucosal enhancement, suggesting that there is some active component. We talked about MR enterography being good for determination of fistulous tracts. Here you see what we call a stellate fistula. So this is an area of inflammation that's basically, in this case, fistulized 1, 2, 3, 4, maybe 5 different small bowel loops into one central area. These are very difficult to treat surgically. If you try to treat them surgically, they come back. Here's a patient that has a very significant stricture that looks predominantly chronic with a very dilated upstream small bowel loop. So this patient ended up requiring surgery to take out this area because this small bowel loop was never going to empty through this. Moving on to pancreatic MR, what is pancreatic MR good for? So it's good for identifying the complications of pancreatitis. Pseudocysts, again, you can probably see those on CT. Ductal disruption, the MR is definitely the best way to evaluate the pancreatic duct. So ductal disruption is important with pancreatitis. It's something that's not often thought about. But if the duct is disrupted from pancreatitis, that patient is never going to heal because they're going to get worse because the isolated duct is just going to dump the pancreatic secretions into their abdominal cavity forever. And so that's a patient that's going to require surgery. So that's a significant change in management. And then evaluation of necrotizing pancreatitis. Again, this is very important for treatment and prognostic evaluation. Characterization of pancreatic cystic lesions, we talked about that quite a bit. MR is definitely the best technique for following up all these pancreatic cystic lesions. And then evaluation of pancreatic malignancy. So one question we get asked is, for pancreatic cancer or pancreatic lesions, should I get CT or MR? And even though I'm an MR guy, I think that pancreatic protocol CT is this equivalent or maybe even actually a little bit better than MR for evaluation and staging evaluation of the vasculature. It's also a little bit easier for the referring surgeons to look at, and they understand pancreatic CT very well. Whereas MR, you know, sometimes they can, there's, you know, 20, 30 sequences. It's not as straightforward for them to look at. So I would say probably as a first line order CT, and then if there's a question from the CT, then move to MR. Just showing some examples of cases. This is without contrast. You can see here a normal pancreas, kind of the normal MR characteristics of a normal pancreas. And here you see a pancreas that has acute on chronic pancreatitis with, you know, kind of thickened, irregular pancreatic parenchyma. It doesn't have the same signal characteristics. The duct is dilated and irregular. Here we see a pseudocyst from acute pancreatitis with a ductal disruption. So here's the duct, and then here's the duct, and there's nothing in the middle. And so this is a patient that's going to require basically at least resection of their pancreatic tail and maybe treatment of the pseudocyst. This is a big lesion that's pushing on the stomach. Here's an example of acute necrotizing pancreatitis. You see peripancreatic inflammation, so edema, fluid around the pancreas, and ascites in the abdomen. You don't see the bile duct very well because of all the edema in the pancreas. Here's an example of a case of a pancreatic cancer that was staged with MR. Here you see kind of that double duct sign. So you see a dilated common bile duct, a dilated pancreatic duct, and something in the middle where there's no duct at all. Here you see an enhancing lesion. And in this example, you see sort of the coronal image of the pancreas lesion. And you can also see that there is invasion of the vasculature on MR. Here's an example of MR on a lesion that's very subtle. I mean, on the T2, you just basically see the duct ends, but you don't clearly see a lesion. Again, very hard to see a defined lesion. But then with contrast, just like with CT, we talked about the contrast resolution and the improved sensitivity with contrast. You clearly see that lesion doesn't enhance like normal pancreas. And so that turned out to be a neuroendocrine tumor. So finishing off, because I wanted to leave some time for questions, GI radiology can be confusing. If you ever have questions, call before you order something that you're not sure if it's going to answer your question. So we're at 7340. Another important thing is that most incidental pancreas cysts can be followed with MR every 1 to 2 years, and use MR for problem solving in rectal cancer or IBD and unexplained abdominal pain and diseases of the pancreas. Thanks. And that's my cell phone number and my extension here at the hospital. If you guys ever have any questions, pick up the phone and call. Go ahead. So we, for MRI, we use a GFR. So the cutoffs are different for CT and for MR. So for CT, we use a creatinine of 1.7. For MR, we use a GFR of 30. So that's important numbers to remember. So they give you the GFR on the labs. So MRCP does not need to be done with contrast. If you're looking for a stone in the duct, if that's your question, just like renal stones, if you're just looking, is there a stone in the duct or not, that question can certainly be answered without contrast. So somebody who has renal failure, you don't have to give them contrast. And for that question, MRCP is definitely the best test. So that would be where I would kind of go on that. And again, if there's ever any questions, you know, call. Sometimes, you know, a lot of times these cases might not be emergent, can be done outpatient. So if the patient's sort of borderline, hydrating them prior to the procedure, you know, letting their renal failure improve a little bit for a day or two, and then getting the test, you know, and being able to do it with contrast as opposed to doing without might be another option. Go ahead. That's a great question. It might be a future lecture. So one of the techniques that we did out at Stanford and that I'm trying to bring here is a technique called MR elastography, which basically measures both. It basically puts an ultrasound transducer on the patient's abdomen while they're getting an MRI, and it measures the fibrosis. So you can actually stage how advanced their fibrosis is, which has been very, very well correlated with pathology. So you can say it's F1 fibrosis, F2 fibrosis based on the MR. You also can get very detailed quantifications of things like iron, things like fat fractions. There is actually a way, and I try to I try to put it in my reports, and I'm trying to get it consistent throughout our group without even having contrast, without having the transducer, of actually quantifying the fat fraction using just the in and out of phase images, which are two of the sequences we do on MRI. So there's a calculation that can be done that's basically an intrinsic principle of MR that generates a fat fraction percentage from MR. So you can say hepatic steatosis with a fat fraction of 15%. We traditionally have called less than 5% as the cutoff, 5% fat, which is basically 5% signal dropout from into out of phase, as the kind of borderline for hepatic steatosis. So we've kind of traditionally called 5 to 10% mild, 10 to 15% moderate, and then greater than 15% as severe hepatic steatosis. And that's how most places, you know, you'll see in our reports, mild hepatic steatosis, severe hepatic steatosis. But I'm trying to get it so that it's more quantified. So you can say, this person has fatty liver with a fat fraction of 30%. That's a person who's going to be very high risk for developing NASH and going on to having cirrhosis from their fatty liver. And that's someone that might need more aggressive management of their metabolic syndrome. In that case, if their fat fraction is 30, 35%, that's someone who has severe fatty liver. And fatty liver versus cirrhosis, basically fatty liver, the way that, you know, I kind of think about it is fatty liver is active hepatic damage. And so somebody who has, you can have fatty liver from a number of reasons. Acute alcohol intoxication can cause imaging features of fatty liver. But basically, once you go to cirrhosis, that's irreversible. And you can fatty liver and cirrhosis are separate things, although you can have cirrhosis and fatty liver at the same time, where you have you've already progressed to cirrhosis, but you're continuing to damage your liver. So that hopefully that, you know, sort of answers your question. As we go to more elastography, we can define more the fibrosis, but we can also quantify the degree of fat, which may be that number, at least you have it and it's useful for you guys to follow. And it could be something that you could follow yearly and say, well, your hepatic steatosis went from 30% to 10%. It seems like whatever you're doing is improving. Good question. So MR enterography, basically the advantage versus CT enterography is on MR enterography, you can actually get dynamic imaging. So you can actually watch the bowel move. So that's something that you can't do on CT because you'd have to, I mean, an MR, we watch and scan them for minutes. So we actually watch their bowel peristalsis for several minutes. You couldn't CT scan someone continuously for 3 or 5 minutes. So that's something that, you know, gives you patterns of, you know, maybe there's an area of stricturing that when you happen to CT scan them, that loop wasn't dilated. But as you watch over time, it dilates and then you can identify a stricture. So that's one advantage. Another advantage, kind of going along those same lines, is that, you know, you can scan over multiple points in time. You can kind of get an evaluation of the bowel over 20 or 30 minutes as opposed to over 10 seconds in a CT. So I think that's probably the main main advantage. The other advantage is that the luminal contrast, I think, because fluid on T2 is intrinsically bright, it basically creates a really nice, differentiation of, like we said, contrast resolution. Highlighting the bowel lumen a little bit better, I think, than MR. But in a patient who's not a candidate for MR because of claustrophobia or altered mental status, then CT enterography is a great test too. Any other questions? Well, thank you guys so much. Like I said, you guys have my numbers. Give me a call anytime.